as usual to be back here and to visit. And of course, the title is deliberately provocative, but I want to argue that in fact, it's the title is correct. So let's see. This is what we see when we look up at the microwave sky. And of course, that's an amazing thing, which inspired us to invent inflation, to know that the Big Bang theory is the right theory, not the steady state theory. And as you can tell here, this is in the microwave sky in galactic coordinates. That's the galactic center, the galactic equator, the galactic anti-center on either side. And for a long time, this is what we were able to know about the microwave background, even though we knew that it shouldn't be perfectly homogeneous because the universe would be perfectly homogeneous, or rather perfectly isotropic since the universe isn't perfectly homogeneous. About 10-ish years later, we were able to see this, which is not at all interesting. It just tells us that we're moving through the microwave background. This is the Doppler dipole, which is a factor of about 1,000 smaller, a few millikelvin. And then finally, in the 1990s, COBE was able to make this map of the fluctuations in the microwave background. You'll recognize the most salient feature, that's this red band in the middle, and that is nothing more than our galaxy, which unfortunately we're stuck looking through when you look at the microwave background, well, fortunately or unfortunately.
Did they really not say that in the very first slide? The orange one? Didn't the orange one really have a red belt in the middle too? Your very first picture.
Yeah. Probably. This is the sky that we have now that WMAP produced. Actually, this is three-year sky, so it's an equivalent five-year sky. And you'll notice, miraculously, that we no longer see the galaxy. Now, of course, that can't possibly be because WMAP left the galaxy and was able to really view the microwave sky without galactic contamination. But rather, this sky...
Sorry.
I'll forgive you this once. But rather, the sky is built from a synthesis of more than one map in which one believes that one can remove the galaxy. Now, in the first year version of this map, called the ILC map, it came with a caveat that said, do not use this map for research. I'm going to use it for research. Now, I should tell you, though, that the map was developed for research. In fact, it was developed in part to do some of the things I'm telling you about. What it really means is, you know, it was really a warning to theorists, because theorists, you know, will take some graph and copy down the points and then, you know, and then write papers about seven sigma detections and things like that. What it really is a warning that this map probably has, for example, some residual galaxy contamination and things like that, and you should be cautious when using it for research. So, for example, if we found the galaxy in this map, we wouldn't be surprised. So this galaxy. And so, while much of the interest in WMAP has been the fact that our view, our ability to look at high angular resolution has improved, I'm actually going to be interested in our ability to look at large scales, at low angular resolution. And a lot of that comes from our ability to remove the galaxy, and a lot of it comes from our improved signal to noise. So the things I want to talk about are, first of all, the largest scale properties of the universe. And I'll try to talk very little about curvature because it's, you know, it's kind of boring. We all know about it. I'll talk some about topology, but I'll mostly focus on what's often been called the low L problem, and which I'd like to suggest to you shouldn't be called the low L problem or the small quadrupole problem, but the large angle problem. And this will inspire us to look beyond either the angular power spectrum or the two-point correlation function and see the solar system in the microwave background. And then to come back and realize that there are troubles in our wonderful cosmological paradise. So when we see a map like this, all of us know what to do. You calculate the angular power spectrum. You expand the fluctuations in spherical harmonics, and because our theory, inflation, tells us that the spherical harmonic coefficients are independent Gaussian random variables of zero mean, which means, among other things, that the expectation value of any pair of them is zero unless they share the same L and the same M. So it's equal to C sub L, which tells us that all of the interesting information on the sky is contained in the angular power spectrum, the C sub L, okay, which is just the average of the squares of the ALM. And if we do that, we get the following graph that you've seen, and I'm not sure which one is. This is the first year version of this, in which the dots are the bin values of the C sub L, so the angular power spectrum measured at as many independent points as you can manage. The line is the best fit lambda CDM model, and the gray band is the cosmic variance, which reflects our inability to predict, essentially, exactly what value these points will assume because of the fact that we only have one realization of the universe. So, for example, of the ALMs with L equals 2, we only get a sample of 5, right? Whereas we'd really like a much larger sample. So with low L, where there's only a few samples of ALM, we have large error bars, and at high L, they're much smaller error. So what can we do with this? Well, one thing we can do with this is measure the shape of the universe, by which we mean, is it a flat space, a positively curved space, or a negatively curved space? And I won't bore you with the details of how we do that, because you know, except to say that it, you know, depends on the position of the first peak. And we find out that omega is somewhere close to 1, exactly what the limit is on a particular day, depends on what other set of data you assume and how you do your analysis, but somewhere very close to 1, consistent with 1. Okay, so we appear to live in a flat space. And then you might ask, well, is there anything interesting left to learn about the universe on the larger scale? And obviously, if the answer was no, I'd stop right here. It'd be a very boring talk. But I'd like to persuade you that there are other things left to learn. And the original motivation for this, for many of us, came from the fact that these points are low. And they're not just low here, they were low in the COBE data. I mean, people noticed that the quadrupole in particular was much lower than it should be, and they said, there's an anomaly.
Is this one sigma error bars? Or...
Yeah, these are one sigma error, but you have to be careful. There's not really sigmas down here. So you can't just double this.
And, yeah.
Okay, so this the lowness of this is something like, well, it depends who analyzes, but anywhere from a few to 10% unlikely. The lowest of the quantum. Okay, so how would we go about explaining it? Well, there are a number of explanations. The first one is, didn't that go away? In other words, when we look at the WMAP 3-year data and the WMAP 5-year data, we discover, and I didn't plot it here, I can plot it later, that the low LCLs went up. Now, you might ask how that could possibly happen when the statistical error bars on these are so small. So it can't be that new statistics and change the measure. It had to be that something systematic changed about that, and I'll discuss that a little later.
Now, what about those glitches on top of
it? Right, and then there's all these glitches as well, and aren't they, you might say, aren't they just as significant, so shouldn't you...
Between WMAP 3 and WMAP
5. Right, so there's also the claim that at least this one went away. In fact, neither of these went away. I won't talk about this one. If you ask me later, I'll tell you why it didn't go away. But I will tell you why this one is still there. So what happened in WMAP 3 is both of these went up. In fact, all three of these went up a little. Okay. And this has to do not with a change in the sky. The sky didn't change very much over the course of a couple of years, but a change of the analysis and what's reported. So in fact, you might ask, what about these other points, and aren't they just as significant? And I'll try to talk about that a little bit later. So one explanation is, well, it went away, so there's nothing to explain. Another explanation is, I never believe a posteriori statistics, but by which means that if I see something surprising that I didn't expect, I ignore it. The third is, I never believe anything less than, and now which one exactly you choose depends whether your background is from particle physics or condensed matter physics or whatever, a 5, 10 sigma, 20 sigma result. The fourth explanation is inflation can do that. And what I'm going to argue is that none of these are really the right explanation. And I'm not sure if, I presume 5 is the explanation, but it's also possible that there's just something wrong with the data now. But if we're going to look for another explanation other than inflation can do that, we have to look beyond the C sub L, and it'll turn out we find something interesting. And our motivation for looking beyond the C sub L has happened to do with a number of people's interest in the possibility that the universe was actually small. And this dates back to the day when people in the mid-90s, before the supernova told us that maybe there was a cosmological constant, that omega was about 0.3 instead of 1, and so that said that there was a characteristic scale in the universe which was smaller than the horizon scale, even the curvature scale, and hyperbolic spaces can be compactified, and the typical size of a compactified hyperbolic space is about the curvature scale. So it meant if the universe was negatively curved, there's a good reason to expect that you might want to look for this topology. Now, why would that be interesting? Because if you have a finite volume space, then you have an absence of long wavelength modes, right? And you might imagine that if there are no long wavelength modes, then fluctuations on long wavelengths don't exist. There are no truly large angle correlations.
So this would be still not in agreement with inflation, probably, no? Because inflation would suggest that actually the universe expanded much more than this around.
Right. So, So, if you can see a finite scale, right, then it says that inflation didn't manage to inflate that scale way beyond the horizon. So in any universe in which we have some finite scale, so in any universe in which you require just a certain amount of inflation so that the largest scales we see are the kind of pre-inflationary in which we only have like 60 or 70 equals inflation, you're going to have a theory of inflation which you only get 60 or 70 equals. So now I should point out that this argument that small universes therefore are an explanation of this small this low amplitude for the quadruple knot hole is actually wrong. And it's wrong because on scales that inflation didn't manage to inflate away, we would expect, in fact, large fluctuations, not small fluctuations, right? Not there's been, unless there's some other mechanism that causes the universe to be homogeneous on these very large scales. So, in fact, this motivation that people had is really not such a good motivation. So this isn't really an explanation for the low LCLs, or at least it alone is not an explanation. But nevertheless, you can still measure the shape of space beyond just the curvature and be interested in, for example, in the topology. So for example, we know that if I take a piece of paper, I can roll it up so that I can, in other words, identify opposite sides, and I'll get a cylinder, and if I glue the circles at each end to each other, I'll get a torus. Now, if we try to do that in this room, and we could do that, we would get a horrible crunched up torus, but that's only because it's very hard to embed a 2 torus in a 3 space, right? You can't do that in a way in which the surface of the torus retains its constant curvature, but that doesn't mean that this is not a flat space. Because if I draw a triangle on here, some of the angles of the triangle will be 90 degrees, and then I roll it up, and it's still 180 degrees, it's still 180 degrees. That's not why, but that's just... So each of these geometries actually admit more than one topology, not just the covering space topology, which is what we usually think about, but also other topologies, including compact topologies. So we're very used to one of those, we're used to the 3 torus. After all, this is how we usually do simulations in cosmology, is not on the covering space, not on the infinite space, but on the 3 torus, so that if we go up out of the top of the 3 torus, we come back in the bottom, out of the right, we come in the left, out of the back, in the front. and we're used to that, but the same thing can be done in hyperbolic space. This is an example called the Weeks topology, and spherical spaces, where there's a fundamental domain, and we identify different faces of the fundamental domain. And what you'd like to do is be able to search for these in the universe. And a number of proposals have been made how to do this. There was a lot of work looking up for planes of symmetry. There was work trying to see if we could see sets of quasars or other objects in some direction and see the analogous set in some other direction. And all of these are very, very hard. And the reason is that the images, these clones of objects that you see by looking off in different directions, you're going to see them at different ages, different orientations. So it's kind of like me looking like this on one way, and then you turn around and you try to see if I'm the same person this way, except in one case I'm 90 years old, in the other case I'm 10 years old. And you try to recognize it as the same person. So the same, you have all sorts of issues with trying to do that with objects. Now, what you'd really like to use is the microwave background radiation, because at least you know that the microwave background radiation is coming to you from a sphere centered on you, so it all was emitted at the same time. And that's a great help. And just over a decade ago, Neil Cornish, David Spergel, and I proposed a signature that works in every topology so long as your nearest neighbor, so long as the tiling is small enough, that your nearest clone is within the diameter of the last scattering surface. And the way that works is to recognize that if I'm over here looking out at the microwave background, it's coming from a sphere centered on me. But if I go to the next copy of the tiling that I live in the covering space, here I am doing a microwave background experiment, and it's coming to me from the last scattering surface, which is a sphere centered on me. Now, those two spheres intersect in a circle so long as I live in a homogeneous geometry. So, if that's the case, that's those circles. This copy of me sees them off in that direction. This copy of me sees them off in that direction. And of course, those two copies of me are the same person. So I can look out in this direction and some other direction and see those same two circles from different sides, but I'll see those same two circles. And so I can go around comparing whether the pattern of temperature fluctuations around those circles is the same. Now, of course, I don't know where to find the circle, so I have to look at every pair of circles on the sky that have the same radius in order to do this. But typically, I'm going to get several of them. So, for example, here are multiple copies of the last scattering surface, and I see multiple pairs of circles, which are identified with each other. So, not all in pairs, so it might be that this circle and some circle down here identified, and if I went around this circle and I went around that circle, then I would find the same pattern of hot and cold fluctuations. And so we can look for that. It's not so easy because there's a lot of possibilities. I don't know where the first circle is, I don't know where the second circle is, I don't know the radius, and I don't know the relative orientations, how to phase each of the two of them. So it's a 6-parameter search in a very large, very finely gridded space, and so it's a tough thing. But we can do it. Let me skip this slide, actually. And here we go. Here is some statistic called S max as a function of the radius of the pair of circles I'm comparing. Okay. So if a pair of circles were perfectly matched, then at that radius, I would find that pair of circles by this number going by this statistic going up to 1. Now, what I have here is this on a simulation, and you'll notice it doesn't go up to 1. And the reason it doesn't go up to 1 is because there are effects that make the circles less correlated. For example, if I have the material on at the last scattering surface is moving, so there's a Doppler effect. And the Doppler effect will contribute with one sign to one side of the an observer on one side of the circle and with another sign to an observer on the other. There's integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect along the line of sight. So there are effects that decorrelate the circles, but nevertheless, you can see that I'm able to pick out all these sets of circles at the various radii where I expect to see circles. And to test this, what we did is we had another group give us a manifold, okay, a sky that they had produced. And as they said, it was a deliberately difficult universe. And what we found is that in the, you know, that blind test, we could find more than 99% of the circles all the way down to about 24 degrees in angular radius. And at larger angular radius, we found a much, much larger fraction. Okay, so what happens when we look at the sky? The answer is we find nothing. So the statistic would have to rise us above this blue line in order to have a 95% confidence level detection, and it doesn't, all the way down to about 24 degrees. And we've now pushed that down to about 20 degrees by carefully filtering out the Lowell contributions to the sky, which tells us that there are no, that was for antipodal circles, back-to-back circles, and these are published results, but we've actually done this for all pairs of circles bigger than about 25 degrees across the sky, which tells us that the universe is bigger than about 90% of the last scattering surface diameter, which means that the shortest closed loop around the universe is bigger than 90% of the diameter of the last scattering surface, or about 24 gigaparsecs. We're repeating.
So, yeah. Last a six parameter search?
That is the six parameter search, yeah. And this is being repeated on the 5-year data, and we expect the sensitivity to improve down to somewhere like a 10 to 15 degree circle. The signature doesn't work if your nearest clone is more than the diameter of the last scattering surface away. One has to look for other techniques, and people are trying to find other techniques that would allow you to search if it's a little bit further. But out to there, it does not seem like the universe is small.
But this is only works for circles on this geometry, right? If you have some irregular closed
It doesn't. All that matters is that the metric is locally homogeneous and isotropic. Okay, so it works in any compactification of H3 E3 or S3, as long as the fundamental domain is smaller.
Right. So I can see or guess somehow that you can go and look for circles.
Right.
But if the two different universe are meeting in very irregular space.
They don't, as long as the geometry is homogeneous. Think in the covering space, and that becomes clear. This confused us for several weeks until we realized if you think of the covering space, it's actually pretty clear that my last scattering surface and any of my clone's last scattering surface, and you know, there's the copy of me that lives in the next tile over. They always intersect in a circle.
This match circle is regardless of the topology. It doesn't care about
topology. Doesn't care about the topology. It only cares that the geometry is homogeneous and isotropic. So, for example, if the geometry was instead of E3, H3, or S3 was H2 cross E, and the radius of curvature was sufficient to make the circles into, they kind of turn into ovals or something like that. If the ovals were more, if the semi-major axis of the oval was more than about a degree different than the semi-minor axis, you'd start degrading the circle. Well, within the context of lambda CDM, we've looked and we include late time in homogeneities. You know, we include the ISW. We basically use the same simulation of the CMB as the W mapping, because exactly the same.
So can I ask something?
Yeah.
So what if the box is smaller than the last scattering circle?
Oh, no, this assumes that the box is basically smaller than the last scattering
circle. But it's within the last scattering
circle. Even if it fits in, this is fine.
But then I don't imagine how you can get a full signal. Maybe two pieces of the circle.
Well, remember, the box is just a tile, is one tile of
them,
right? So
there are charts, I think, over here.
So if we're in a small box and this is the last scattering surface, let's take, so here's my last scattering surface, and this last scattering surface will look like this, and then right here is a circle. Okay. I look out this way and see the circle. One circle, another circle, I look out at this angle in this direction, see the circle. My clone, who's just in the next tile over, looks out in this direction, sees the circle. So even with this wrong assumption that somehow the universe, if we inflated one of these topologies, that the universe would still be, we would know that it's that's homogeneous, and that the amplitudes of the modes would be small, we would still find that the doesn't seem like it would explain what is viewed as the low quadrupole problem. Now, the thing is, as I'd like to point out, it isn't really a low quadrupole problem. We can view it better if we look not in L space, but in angle space. So another way to say it is that large angles, there seems to be something funny happening. So notice that in L space, it's really just this one that's low, and this one is fine. Everything else is fine. So it doesn't look terribly anomalous. So let's look in angle space, though. So instead of looking at the two-point at the angular power spectrum, let's look at the two-point correlation function, which means take any pair of points on the sky separated by an angle theta and multiply their temperatures and then add average over the entire sky. And here's what you get. So the green curve is what we expect from our best fit lambda CDM model. And the black curve is what we actually measure. Now, the problem is I haven't put error bars on this. What are the error, we have to ask, what are the error bars look like? It's in many ways easier to see the error bars in L space because we have a finite number of data points, the C sub L's, whereas here we have a function. So it's a little bit more tricky. Now, there's this established lore that tells us that there's no reason to look at the two-point correlation function because, after all, the two-point correlation function is just the Legendre transform of the angular power spectrum. And so it has the same information in it. Why bother looking at the angular power spectrum? Well, first of all, this isn't true. It would be true if either the two-point correlation function is obtained by a full sky average, so if we use all of the data on the sky to obtain the two-point correlation function. But remember, we're worried about the part of the sky behind the galaxy, so it's not clear that we want to do that. Or if the sky is statistically isotropic, which our theory tells us it is, but it may or may not be, so we should be careful about it. The other thing is that we know that there are times when, for example, a time series, a signal is clearly visible in a time series, but if you Fourier transform, you don't see it. Or vice versa, where a signal is very hard to see in a time series, and we want to take the Fourier transform in order to see the signal. Okay? So just because we don't see, we have this very clear problem here that the two-point correlation function seems to be very, very small from about 60 degrees out, that wasn't terribly visible in the angular power spectrum, where it just seemed to be about the quadrupole being low, but it seems to be very clear in the two-point correlation function. So let's ask this question. We're going to ask this question is, how likely is it that the two-point correlation function, this black line, should be so close to zero on the sky?
What was the toy model that they...
Oh, the toy model, they cut out some of the low k's.
So, actually, make a comment here? So you can define C sub L through that equation.
Yes.
And then, that's true by definition.
Right. Okay,
what is the sky? If it is the cut sky.
Yes, so that's right. You can define C sub L by this, even if it's a cut sky. We're going to look exactly at what happens if you define C sub L that way.
So this is actually what people call pseudo
C. That's exactly what people call pseudo C L. Right. Well, it's approximately what they call pseudo.
Actually, that's exact. I think that's exact.
Well, it depends whether you use cross bands and things like that. But essentially, it's what you call pseudo.
So, but the claim is that although you can define it that way, you lose information unless those things are true.
Well, it's different information. You lose it or gain it. I mean, in other words, if you calculate this thing, it's one object, and calculating the C sub L's. Not by doing a Legendre transform, but by doing what I did before, which is you know, suggested that we do a spherical harmonic transform over the sky and then invert the cut if we're doing a galaxy cut, or for example, doing a maximum likelihood estimate of the C sub L's from a cut sky. That isn't the same thing as doing a 2-point correlation directly, and then Legendre transform. Yeah, so they're slightly different, and we'll see that in.
You said that to compare those curves meaningfully, you wanted to put error bars on there.
Right.
Were you going to do that?
Yeah, I'll show you some error bars. Yeah.
What do you mean by Legendre transform?
Well, I just mean this is a PL is a Legendre transform. A Legendre polynomial expansion. So, to compare these W map key matching, which notice that this was something that was seen in COBE. Okay? So the COBE team noticed that they didn't seem to have any very much 2-point correlation function above 60 degrees. But what's interesting is that in the astronomical world, one tends to use 2-point correlation functions, not spherical harmonics, partly because one is usually interested in objects. It's much easier to talk about the 2-point correlation function of objects than to talk about the spherical harmonic expansions. Whereas in the microwave background world, we tend to talk about the angular power spectrum. So by the time the COBE team published in their fourth year of data the 2-point correlation function, people had kind of not really stopped really looking at the 2-point correlation function. So when Gary Hinshaw saw the absence of the 2-point correlation function, he said, oh, didn't we see something like that? And in fact, they discussed the fact that there's very little 2-point correlation function above 60 degrees. So here is a statistic that measures the 2-point correlation function above 60 degrees. Now, you might ask, why 60 degrees? In other words, why this a half? Isn't that a posteriori? And the answer is, yeah, the half was kind of, COBE kind of suggested the half, right, by noticing that it was 60 degrees. And so but ever since then, you know, what would we have expected? So in COBE, this absence turns out to be about 5% significant, 5% unlikely. And then we would have expected this effect not to get any worse, right? We had one sky, COBE saw it, was about 5% unlikely that we have this little 2-point correlation function. And we would have expected that as we measure the sky better, that the significance remains around 95%. Well, let's see what happens. Well, WMAP1 measured and said, well, actually only 0.15% of realizations of the best fit lambda CDM universe have this as low a value of this statistic, which measures a 2-point correlation function of greater than 60 degrees. So only 0.15% of realizations have a lower value of this statistic.
But Greg, yeah. Was this published? This that for at least 5% for COBE?
Well, okay, so what? No, no one actually ever published this.
That is still a cluster, yeah.
Well, the only thing that's a posteriori, it turns out not to matter much whether you do this or some absolute value. What was noticed is 60 degrees. So that's the part that's really
so that's in one of the COBE's paper. In one of the COBE papers, is this quantity calculated?
This quantity is not, but the fact that it's 60 degrees is. So it's the thing is, what's really a posteriori about this, if you like, is the half. Okay, so we should, you know, as I may or may not show you, it doesn't matter. It makes a difference if you take this to one, but you still get something very small. Okay, that S1 half is still very small, even if you go from 0 degrees to 180.
Did anybody calculate that 5%? If it wasn't for this, what was 5%?
You can take the COBE and look and see and calculate this and find that it's about 5%. There's huge error bars on this number from COBE.
So even 5% is a posterior. Okay, after you define this today. Well,
right. So this statistic was first defined by WMAP. But the answer doesn't depend much on the statistic. I can use the absolute value instead of the square, for example. I mean, what was a posteriori is COBE noticing that the vanishing happens somewhere around 60 degrees. So people back then noticed that around 60 degrees is where this effect is. So let's take that as a given now, that's 60 degrees. All right. So this suggests that maybe there's something odd happening on large angular scales. So let's look at those large angular scales. And there's lots of things people have done, and I'm going to talk just about one of them. And you may have heard of some related ones from Jean Legeju. I'm going to talk about something called multiple vectors, which characterize the shape and alignment of the multiples. What does that mean? Well, way back in 2003, Dolivera Costa, Tegmark, Zaldarriaga, and Hamilton noticed that if instead of calculating the C sub L's, which are the sum over ALM squared, if you calculated this quantity, the sum over M of M squared ALM squared, now that, which is the angular momentum dispersion of the ELF multiple, now this quantity depends on what you choose for your axis. It's not rotationally invariant. So if you maximize it, if you adjust your axis until you maximize it, you get the axis around which the angular momentum dispersion is maximized. I'm not sure why they calculated this, but they did. And they noticed that this axis for the quadrupole and the octuple are very, very closely aligned. And they also noticed that the octuple is unusually planar, is what they said. In other words, when you do this, the A3Ms are mostly M equals 3. Now, around the same time, we were trying to find a way to look for topology beyond the horizon. And we were asking, well, what's characteristic of a fundamental domain is that there are special directions. And so we wondered, what are the directions associated with the ELF multiple? Could we go through the multiples, look to see if they define a special direction and find it? So what are the directions associated with the ELF multiple? Well, for the dipole, that's easy, right? The dipole we think of as a vector. It has some magnitude and some direction. Okay. So we exchange our A1Ms for some overall scalar and then some unit vector. And this is an advantage. It has an advantage because this unit vector is, in fact, a vector. Well, actually, it's a headless vector. And A is a scalar. And all the information about the strength of the dipole is in A and about the orientation is in this unit vector. Well, it turns out you can do the same thing for a general L. You can exchange the 2L plus 1 ALMs for one scalar and L unit vectors. And this is nothing more than the statement that I can build an angular momentum L object out of L angular momentum 1 objects. And the advantage is that all of the information about the strength of the multiple is in the scalar, and all of the information about kind of the orientation, the relative phases of the multiple are in these headless unit vectors. Now, we thought we had invented it. It turns out there's this other fellow a while back, and he had, instead of writing the sum over M of ALM, YLM, had written a product of L directional derivatives of 1 over R when he wanted to represent multiples. You may have heard of him. His name is Maxwell, and it's how Maxwell thought of spherical harmonics in his treatise on electricity and magnetism. Okay, so they're originally invented. Well, I don't know if they were invented by Maxwell, but he certainly used them. Now, what you notice then is that the quadrupole has two vectors. In other words, you can think of the quadrupole as a plane. And it turns out that the direction that maximizes the angular momentum dispersion of the quadrupole is nothing more than the axis of that plane. And the octupole has three vectors. In other words, you can think of it as three planes. And if the octupole, if those three planes are aligned, then the axis that maximizes the angular momentum dispersion of the octupole is that the axis of those three planes. So if we look at these area vectors, these cross products of the multiple vectors, they carry all some but not all of the information. And let me plot them for you on the sky. So this is in again, the galactic equator, the galactic center, and I have a bunch of dots and lines in there, and let me tell you what they are. So here is the area, the direction of the area vector of the quadrupole, this dark gray. And here are, and notice it's a headless vector, so I'm plotting in both the northern and southern hemisphere. There are three such vectors for the three planes of the octupole. There's one of them, there's another, and there's another. And you'll notice that they're all kind of in a small part of the sky. Most of the sky is empty. What are the other things? Well, they're all gathered around this dashed line, which is the ecliptic, the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun. They're also pretty near the dipole, the direction that the solar system is moving through the microwave background. One of them is actually pretty near the supergalactic plane, you know, and they're also pretty close to the equinox. Now, why choose the ecliptic and the supergalactic plane and the galactic poles to put on here? Because those are directions that you can imagine being associated with the experiment. After all, the satellite is orbiting in the orbit of the Earth. It's sitting in the galaxy. They have to remove the dipole. That's the biggest contaminating signal. And so you might imagine that somehow the quadrupole and octupole might have become accidentally correlated with these various directions. And what you see is that they are, or at least it appears that they are. We should test the statistical significance. But they're clumped around the ecliptic. This one maybe is close to the galactic pole. They seem to be clumped around the dipole. Is this statistically significant? Well, it turns out that the most statistically significant thing is, so this is, in a sample of 100,000 realizations of Gaussian random ALMs of the best fit lambda CDM, what fraction, what percent of the time would the quadrupole and octupole planes be so aligned with each other? And depending on which version of that map you use, it's about between 0.1% and 0.6% of the time. Now, interestingly, if you forget to subtract the Doppler contribution to the quadrupole, the answer is less significant by a factor of 5. So when you then remember that actually the quadrupole gets a contribution from the Doppler effect, the effect tightens up by a factor of 5 or so, which is kind of surprising if it's not real.
You mean the motion of the...
The motion, yeah. Right. And everyone knew that there was a Doppler correction to the quadrupole, but you can show that it's not an important correction to the magnitude of the quadrupole, but it turns out to be an important enough correction to the orientation of the quadrupole that this changes the alignment, improves the alignment by a factor of 5. There are also correlations to the ecliptic plane, to the North Galactic Pole, maybe to the dipole, and to the dipole and the equinox. So let's take the assumption that the quadrupole and the octupole seem to be aligned with each other and ask, okay, what's the probability that they would be this aligned to these physical directions? So they're aligned with each other. What's the chance, given that they're that aligned, that they would be so aligned with physical directions having to do with the geometry of the solar system or the galaxy? So here is a histogram as we vary the orientation of the quadrupole and octupole together. So as we rotate the sky and ask, how close does that common direction align with, you know, the direction to the North Galactic Pole or to the dipole or the equinox or the supergalactic plane or the ecliptic plane? And what we find is that very, very few of those rotated realizations of the sky have these planes so incredibly perpendicular to the ecliptic. So the quadrupole and octupole, these four planes of these two multipoles, are aligned with each other, and they're incredibly perpendicular to the ecliptic. Very, very unlikely that they'd be this perpendicular. Only what you find over here, on that side of that dashed line.
What's the scale from the?
Oh, this is, you know, we had
just numbers.
Number of realizations. So, you know, maybe 1,000 of realizations out of 100,000. The correlation with the supergalactic plane, not obviously statistically significant. It could be an accident with the North Galactic plane. With the dipole and the equinox, it's a little bit harder to tell, maybe 5%.
Sorry, probably. I don't understand. What's the difference between ecliptic plane and supergalactic plane? I mean,
the ecliptic plane is the plane of the Earth's orbit.
Yeah, but for this statistical analysis, what's the difference?
Well, okay, so what you find is...
Does it have to do with a mask or no?
No. All we've done is we have this quadrupole and octupole forming a plane, and they're pointing in some direction. We ask, how often when you rotate the sky do you get the correlations we saw with the ecliptic or with the supergalactic plane And so the correlation with the ecliptic plane happens in something like between, depending on your map, between 0.2 and 1.7% of the time in random realizations. For other things, it's, you know, for the correlation with the North Galactic and South Galactic plane is no real statistical significance. With the dipole and the equinox, it happens, you know, maybe 5% of the time that you'll have, that the planes will be pointed this well towards the dipole or the equinox. Okay, so what do we have? We have these quadrupole and octupole forming an unusually tight plane, one plane, perpendicular to the ecliptic, and pointed towards the dipole and the equinox. The first effect is unlikely that they're so aligned at the 0.1% level. The next one conditionally is unlikely at about the 1% level. And the third one is then conditionally unlikely at the few percent level.
What's making the difference between these different planes? Is it the motion of the Earth or the galactic subtraction? Or
what? What do you mean? Between the different
maps? Why shouldn't the alignment be the same with any plane, given that in your simulation?
No, we have the real sky, which has a quadrupole and octupole, and they have some alignment. They have some particular alignment on the sky that happens to be very perpendicular to the ecliptic.
Right.
And we ask, well, okay, how perpendicular to the ecliptic it is. So what we do is we randomly rotate the sky.
Oh, but you're always using the real
sky. Always using the real sky. We randomly rotate the sky and ask, well, how often does it turn out to be this perpendicular to the ecliptic? And the answer is less than 1% of the time. Now, recall that the area vectors told me something. They told me that the orientations of the normals of these planes, but they don't tell me how to rotate these planes around their axes. So there's some information missing about those in these area vectors, which is all I've used so far. So we still are able to rotate the aligned planes about their common axis. And what we find when we do that is, if we look at the picture of what's going on, the quadrupole and the octupole give us six hot and cold spots, basically around a ring on the sky. And when the question is, how are those oriented with respect to the solar system? So here's how. So here are the hot and cold spots around the sky, and here is the ecliptic plane. And you notice that the ecliptic plane very carefully traces out the zero line between the hottest, the most extreme extrema, and the least extreme extrema. So these are the most extreme, next most extreme, these are tied, the least to extreme. And it very carefully traces out this line. It's a little bit harder to estimate the statistical significance of this. It seems to be about a few percent of the time you get something this aligned. Even once you had conditioned on all these other things, right? Namely that this plane is already perpendicular to the ecliptic, already pointing towards the dipole, okay, and already forms such a good plane. So this is what the sky looks like. You can also notice something called the north-south asymmetry. This side has much stronger extrema than this side. Now, how do you explain this? Well, it's pretty hard for it to be cosmology, because cosmology isn't supposed to know about the solar system. It might be systematics, but no one really has identified a systematic that could do this. That's the bottom line. So let me point, but there is something very interesting, because remember these other glitches? It turns out that they're also correlated with the ecliptic. So notice that there's a glitch here around 20, here around 40, here near the first peak. Here is the same angular power spectrum, but calculated separately on the portion of the sky near the ecliptic plane and the portion of the sky near the ecliptic poles. So notice that the dip here happens only in this light gray one. The peak here happens only in the light gray one. The dip here happens only in the light gray one, which are all for the portion of the sky near the ecliptic poles. Now, how can that be when other people looked at the first peak and didn't see a dip? Here is boomerang data from the first peak. There's no dip there. Well, it turns out that there is another experiment that may have seen a dip. It's not very statistically significant, but here it is. It's the Archaeops experiment. It seemed to see a dip near the first peak. So what is the difference between the Archaeops experiment and WMAP versus all these other experiments? And the answer is that those are the only two experiments that looked at a large fraction of the sky, including the part of the sky near the North Ecliptic Pole. And in fact, in work that I should be posted in a few weeks, we've been able to localize this dip to a region around the North Ecliptic Pole. Now, it's been suggested that this dip went away in the third and fifth year data. It didn't, in fact, go away. It's still there. It's just that what's changed is the way that this analysis is done used to overweight parts of the sky that were observed more. And now it weights them all equally. Well, it turns out that the parts of the sky that are observed the most are the North and South Ecliptic Poles. So that amplified the effect in the way that the first year data was observed, was reported, and de-amplified it in the way the third and fifth year data was reported. So it's there in the North Ecliptic Polar region, there's a dip in the first peak.
Can you say again, why is it de-amplified?
Compared to amplified. Way different.
Yeah.
Now, remember that we were supposed to worry about that map that we're using from the first place, because after all, we were told not to do research with it. But the thing is, we didn't end up finding the galaxy in it. In fact, the galaxy has the wrong multiple structure compared to what we see. What we see is an aligned Y22 and Y33 in the appropriate axis, and I always forget, the galaxy is like a Y20 plus a Y31, or I don't remember. But it's not Y22 plus Y33.
But actually, the last reason you said why it wouldn't be systematic, but just for the glitch at the peak, and so the large angle anomalies have nothing to do. I mean, they could still be systematic.
Right, but all I'm saying is that there's evidence. I said no one knows of a systematic, but what I was actually suggesting is that it may be a systematic, it may be something local. Right? It may be some local foreground or some local effect in the solar system, or
okay.
It may be something systematic about how they analyze data that's connected to the solar system. Okay. The other thing is, we didn't find a correlation with the galaxy. We found a correlation with the solar system. So why would we see the galaxy in a map that's supposed to, the solar system in a map that's supposed to be galaxy? It's also difficult to explain it with kind of cosmological foregrounds because in particular, if you change a patch of the sky, it typically gives you YL0s, not YLLs. It's also hard. The sky has about 5 times more octopole than quadrupole, and that tends to be hard. Most explanations rely on some sort of perturbation theory explanation, which almost always gives you a smaller quadrupole than octopole. Now, did this story change in later years? And the answer is, well, there's a mildly changed quadrupole. But really, the biggest issue is they reported something different for the C sub L's. Instead of reporting the pseudo-C sub L's, the Legendre expansion of the two-point correlation function, they report the maximum likelihood estimates of coefficients of the Legendre polynomial expansion of C sub L. Now, the quadrupole and octopole are still strange. They're still planar, they're still aligned with each other, they're still perpendicularly ecliptic, the normal still points for the external dipole, and they're still oriented so that the ecliptic separates the extremum. None of that has changed. So to suggest the skies that we see, at least, if we use the whole sky, is not statistically isotropic. On the other hand, here it is in the third year data. Notice that there doesn't seem to be these big a low L anomaly. This number has moved up a bit. These numbers have all moved up. What happened to the low L anomaly? Well, here again is that two-point correlation function. And here it is for WMAP1. I'm actually going to show it to you for WMAP3. So here is what the theory tells us we should get. And the blue band is the error bars. Okay, so it's the range of things we should get. That doesn't mean that you can randomly pick, say, this point, like this, because it's a function. If you start here, you're going to stay up above, and so you'll end up within these error bars. Here is what we see in the bands that contribute to the CMB most, the Q, the V, and the W bands. Okay? The red line, the green line, and the yellow line where I've only plotted them outside the galaxy. In the part of the sky that we really trust, and we can look at those bands directly, here they are, and notice that they essentially vanish about 60 degrees, except for this anti-correlation pattern. If we do the same thing with this ILC map and look at the part of the sky outside the galaxy, same thing. The dashed line. It matches the bands. If we take the angular power spectrum reported by WMAP from this maximum likelihood estimate, or if we take the two-point correlation function calculated over the whole sky, they agree, but they give something different, which tells us that the two-point correlation function that we see above 60 degrees on the whole sky is actually coming not from the part of the sky outside the galaxy. Sorry, inside the galaxy. It's related to the galaxy. If we look at the part outside the galaxy, we don't see any two-point correlation function. So let's ask, how significant is that? We use that statistic again. So if we look at the V band, for example, the probability that we'd have as low a value of the statistic S 1/2 as we do on the sky is about 0.04%. Same for the W band, 0.04%. For the ILC map, about 0.02%. If you use the full sky, it's about 5%. Same thing in the five-year map. 0.02 to 0.04% on the ILC map outside the galaxy, about 0.02%. On the full sky, about 5%. So you can see the difference is that the theory tells us that this value of S1/2 should be about 50,000, and instead the numbers we were measuring are around 1,000 on the sky outside the galaxy. So here, for example, is if we calculate the two-point correlation function on the full sky, we get this black line. If we calculate it outside the galaxy, we get this red line. If we calculate it on pairs of points where at least one of the points is inside the galaxy, we get this blue curve. Notice that the blue curve almost completely explains the two-point correlation function on the full sky. That's almost the entire two-point correlation function above 60 degrees is due to pairs of points where at least one of them is inside the galaxy.
What's the green?
The green is where the green is if we put both of them inside the galaxy. Okay? So it's not both of them inside the galaxy. That explains a lot of it. But a lot of it.
One in one.
But the rest of it is one in one.
Because there are many more pairs. Yeah,
that, and there are many more pairs with one in one out. So. But notice what this says is that on the part of the sky that we trust, there's essentially no two-point correlation function. And we can imagine that even this little bit seems to probably due to residual contamination from the galaxy. Is this an accident? Well, we take the full sky and rotate it around, and we find that only 2% of the full skies, which already had a two-point correlation function that was only 5% likely, only 2% of those rotated full skies will have this little two-point correlation function outside the galaxy.
Right, in the paper you showed, the prediction for Lambda Cygni, was it full sky or without?
Well, the prediction for the theory doesn't matter, right? No. The error bars will change depending on when you have a cover. Only 2% of rotated and cut full skies have this low in S1. Okay, so maybe what we're learning is that the two-point correlation function is just different. Right? Inflation could give us that. It could just tell us that you have the wrong two-point correlation function. Well, there's a problem with that. Because it turns out, first of all, the first thing we learn is that this is not just due to the quadrupole. How do we learn that? Well, let's hold C3, C4, C5, C6, etc. fixed and ask how low, if we took the theoretical values of C3, 4, 5, and 6, etc. constant, how low could we get the quadrupole? And the answer is nowhere near as low as we see sorry, the two-point correlation function. The answer is nowhere near as low as we see. In fact, it turns out that we have to vary at least C2, C3, C4, and C5. This is nothing more than the statement that what we're really seeing is a conspiracy between these in order to get such a low value of the two-point correlation function. They have to be, it's not just the low quadrupole, it's the relationship between the quadrupole, the octupole, the hexadecapole, or whatever you call C5. In order to get this point, this low two-point correlation function. But the other thing is that suppose we replace the theoretical CLs by their observed values up to L equals 20. And then we did realizations of that sky. And we then went ahead and measured S1/2 on that sky. So we measured the two-point correlation function. It turns out that only 3% of those realizations will have a S1/2 as low or lower than the one we observed. So even if we take our inflationary model and make it look like the thing we see, we don't get something that gives us, we only 3% of the time will we get something that gives us this low a two-point correlation.
But what do you mean by observed value?
Well, what I mean is take the theoretical C sub L's, draw ALMs from that a distribution, Gaussian randomness, Gaussian isotropic, distribution characterized by those C sub L's, and now go ahead and produce a sky and measure the two and calculate the correlation.
So if you replace the theoretical C sub L by their observed values.
The observed values from W.
But there's the pseudo C L's from that.
No, sorry, no, the pseudo C L's, the ones calculated outside of the Gauss.
But that's by definition, this gives you the same correlation function.
No, it only gives you an expectation value of the same correlation. But then there's going to be cosmic variance. And the point is that cosmic variance spoils, if you assume that C2, 3, 4, and 5 are independent, cosmic variance will spoil the relationship between C2, 3, 4, and 5 such that you won't get such a low two-point correlation function.
I think I don't think this is necessary. Maybe the masking, if a homogeneous and a full sky, this couldn't be true because in a full sky, C sub L is just another way of writing
What I mean is, suppose as the theoretical value, suppose we forget about lambda CDM below L equals 20, and instead we just take what we measured for CL as the values that that the theory would have for those values for those L's. Okay. So in other words, it's a set of CLs designed to give us a low two-point correlation. In fact, the two-point correlation function that we see.
But you say that cosmic variance then you ruin.
Cosmic variance ruins them. Only in 3% of the realizations we have this low as instead of a two-point correlation.
What do you do to the inflation model?
I don't know. I'm not worried about that. Okay, let me not worry, but let me just imagine that presumably there's some power spectrum that I can write down that would do that. Let me just do that. Okay. And I still, in other words, what this says is if you believe the full sky CMB maps, that there are signs of the failure of statistical isotropy that are very statistically significant. If you take the most significant individual one, it's 99.9%. If you multiply some of the conditional probabilities together, as you think you'd be able to do, you get somewhere, 99.995. I've seen people put several more nines. The observed fluctuations seem to be correlated to the solar system, but not to other directions with any great statistical significance.
By which you mean the ecliptic.
By which I mean the ecliptic and either the dipole or the equipoise. If you don't believe the CMB inside the galaxy, and you probably shouldn't, if not for no other reason than what I said, then the CMB shows signs of a distinct lack of large angle correlation that was first seen by Kobe at about the 95% significance, but is now 99.975% significance. The low LCLs, that means I therefore measuring small angle, not large angle correlations. And this, but more importantly, this lack of correlations is inconsistent with Gaussian random statistically isotropic ALM at about 97% confidence. This could be due to statistical fluctuations, but that's incredibly unlikely. It could be due to an topology, but we haven't seen topology. It could be due to features in the inflaton potential, but that's contrived and still only has a 3% chance that the large angle correlations would be this small. So we can't trust, I would conclude that we can't trust the reported low L microwave background to be cosmological. that the low L multiples are measuring structure at smaller than expected scales, that the removal of the foreground will probably mean even lower two-point correlation functions at large angles. It's hard for a foreground to mask power. And that this contradicts the predictions of generic inflationary models at greater than 99.97% confidence level, and of contrived models at about the 97% confidence level. Thanks.
So, about this lack of power margin, so there are two ways I could imagine this happening. Either there's some cutoff in the power spectrum for inflation, some primordial effect.
Right.
Or it's a long line of sight. So ISW somehow cancels this thing.
Right.
But it seemed, maybe, I'm not sure if this is correct, but it seemed you could test this by looking at polarization as well. So
right.
Polarization is not sensitive to ISW. And so you could imagine, I just don't know how it looks like this in real space, this correlation function of temperature polarization.
So these are all things we're thinking about. The problem is right now the polarization isn't good enough. Right.
But I know, like, seeing people, they're looking for reasons, you know,
right,
things they couldn't measure, so presumably they would get this back on.
Right. So there's a few things coming up. So first of all, if we can measure low L polarization better, this presumably will allow us to at least distinguish between
primordial.
Right.
Aren't you dominated by randomization for things like that, for low L polarization?
I don't know how it looks like in real space.
Planck may help us in the following way. The difference between WMAP and COBE were very similar experiments and may have the same systematics. Planck, whereas WMAP and COBE look at two places and compare the temperatures, Planck will actually look at each individual place on the sky and measure the temperature. So it should be easier to eliminate. We should see whether the two-point correlation function really does vanish outside the galaxy, or whether that was some sort of systematic of having to build the maps out of pairs of points and stuff.
When you get data like that, you have to use the analysis of people programs.
Yeah. Well, depends where you're looking in the pipeline. So different groups have produced different ILCs. A bigger question is: has there been more than one pipeline to produce maps that have then been analyzed? And the answer is yes. But we analyzed. There's a fellow named Peter Freeman at Carnegie Mellon that has an independent pipeline, and we looked at some of his maps, but only a band map. He hasn't done an ILC yet, and we're in fact he's going to give us one. Yes.
So you're seeing an anomaly. Someone should actually sit there from scratch.
Yeah. Well, Freeman has done that. He has a completely independent pipeline to take time order data to maps.
The same lack of power,
at least in the bands.
For individual frequencies.
Yeah. Which, and it's very hard to see if you don't have power in the bands, how can you have power in the combination map that you trust? Right. So, there's actually an interesting suggestion, I'm trying to remember the names of the authors, that is wrong because they misunderstood what people did, but may nevertheless be right. So what they pointed out is that you suppose if you build a map, okay, out of pairs of points on the sky, you know, reconstruct the map, and then you want to mask the galaxy, you shouldn't really mask the map. You should mask the time order data. You should eliminate from your sample any pair of points in which one of the horns is inside the galaxy. And then they claim that if you do that, that you'll find that there are large angle effects. I mean, it's not so surprising, in fact, then that you would induce correlations between the galactic region and the region outside. Right? Now, it turns out that WMAP does do that. So I'm not sure why they didn't realize that WMAP does do that. But when they build the maps, WMAP does do that. For the part of the sky outside the KP4 mass, which is a very, very narrow mass, they to reconstruct that, they don't include any points inside the KP4 mass. And they reconstruct that part of the sky. And then they go back and reconstruct the points inside the KP4 mass by taking times where one of the horns was inside the KP4 map. And so, relating it to the part outside. But the problem is the KP4 mask is a very, very narrow mask. And, we're looking at the KP0 mask, so it's not clear that it's correct to use a KP0 mask on a sky which was produced using this KP4 masking technique. And so we're going back and we just realized this by reading their paper and then talking to the WMAP people to find out what they do. And so we're going back and Peter Freeman's producing KP0 mask skies built from with a KP0 mask built right in to see if this helps the problem.
A sort of related thing, has anyone looked at what it's called, the solar elongation? So presumably for each pair of points, you're measuring them in a whole set of different geometries where the sun is then relative to it. So you'd imagine if this is some signal due to the ecliptic plane that, you're getting some scattering mechanism
right.
or something, that it might actually be sensitive to.
Right, so, the answer is that WMAP, unreported, has looked, for example, for 1 year or 6 month periods in temperatures, and they don't see them.
Okay.
The other thing is that the pattern, most of things like that you can think of don't end up giving you this plane perpendicular to the galaxy. They end up giving you something more like a YLM whose axis is parallel, who's a plane parallel to the galaxy, to the ecliptic, not perpendicular to the ecliptic.
I mean, I guess I was thinking if you had, variations in the solar wind or variations in the gain of the thing,
right.
that you have some annual signal
right.
if you're modulating,
right.
and then you get a net.
Right. So the thing about the solar wind signal is this effect should go, change from year one to year two to year three. And we have looked at shorter period maps. So it turns out you can build a map from 6 months plus a day of data.
Okay.
And so we've looked at shorter period maps, and we don't see any clear signal that this is a time-dependent effect.
So this octupole and quadrupole are basically lined up and they're orthogonal to the ecliptic.
Yeah,
this last seems a bit strange, so I don't think this test was done. If it has, correct me, but if it hasn't, is it reasonable to say, well, maybe this orthogonality to the ecliptic is some observational bias effect nobody's ever thought of? So can you ask, given that octupole is orthogonal to the ecliptic and quadrupole is and so on,
yeah.
can you take that as input and then do other statistical tests to see how likely all the other...
Right, well, that's the... That,
or is that, if
yeah,
you did
that's
that already,
the,
I lost
yeah, that turns out to be a couple of percent likely.
Okay, so that's...
Like 5%.
So that was looked at, and it's
right.
not likely...
It's about a 1 in 20
okay.
chance.
Okay. Well, 1 in 20 is 1 in 20.
Right, 1 in 20 is 1 in 20. I don't know
about that. Specific.
Right, exactly. It's not, and arguably, you should double that, because we also would have noticed if it was perpendicular to the... Sorry, you were asking if it's... this likely that it would be pointed towards the dipole, or that it would be this perpendicular to the ecliptic?
This perpendicular.
Oh, no, that's less than a 1% chance. Much less than a 1% chance, yeah.
If we assume that this lack of power by 60 degrees is correct,
yeah.
then what are we going to do with inflation more? For example, maybe inflation perhaps not uniform?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is, I think that's the most interesting cosmological part. The fact that you have a quadrupole and octupole that are perpendicular to the ecliptic suggests that, in fact, the quadrupole and octupole we're seeing have nothing to do with the CMB. Right? They have to do with some local effects. So the interesting thing is that is this lack of angular correlations above 60 degrees, and the even more interesting thing is that it doesn't seem like you can get that out of Gaussian random statistically isotropic ALMs of zero mean. So now that means we better start figuring out which of that set of assumptions, Gaussian, statistically isotropic, or zero mean, how do you break those? How do you change those? Do you change the last scattering surface? Do you change it in the propagation? And I think there are different answers. I don't know that there are compelling answers yet. I know people are working on it, and I'm sure that
the problem is you're reaching a reasonable model section spent.
Yes.
It becomes unattractive.
Well, yeah, I mean, one viewpoint would be that inflation is a very good way to parameterize, has been so far a very good way to parameterize our knowledge, at least, even if it is an explanation. Then at some point, you know, at some point, is it even a good way to parameterize the knowledge if you have to keep it? But we don't have a better one at the moment. That's really the challenge.
Yes, so when Raul was here, we did some analysis, unfortunately not complete, in the way that I would have liked to do best, but of these two things, the low power and the anisotropy, so-called right. axis of evil. I don't know who gave that name. Maybe it was
Zhao.
Okay.
And Kate.
And of course, we didn't take into account this distinction between the power spectrum, between the correlation function and the ALM as you're leaving the galaxy out of whatever you're talking about. But the conclusion we came to was that we shouldn't take seriously the low power, the lack of power.
We should take
seriously the anisotropy. But now you've shown that you've given strong evidence that we shouldn't take the anisotropy seriously either, because at least not for cosmological.
I would turn purposes. Around. And see, there's a very good. In fact, the way to understand why the two-point correlation function. Why you get a significant answer in the two-point correlation function and not out of the angular power spectrum is, if you wanted to calculate the difference between, say, C of theta observed and C of theta theory, okay, if what was weird is this, okay, you know, so if I wanted to take some norm of this integrated from minus 1 to half, okay, we could ask, how weird is this? This would be like asking, why are the C sub L's dB? How do you mean for the C sub L's? And it turns out that the probability of this quantity being as big as it is, and that is the observed two-point correlation function differing from the prediction, is about 10%. Just like the probability of C2 being this low is about 10%. But the point is, that's not what's weird about the two-point correlation function. It's not that it differs from theory, although it does. It doesn't look anything like the theory. And that only got worse in year 3 and 5. What's weird about it is that it agrees with another theory, 0, which is, you know, of course we could always find a theory in which it agrees perfectly, but 0 is a rather odd theory.
That was the kind of analysis we did. You might call it Bayesian analysis. So it wasn't precisely comparing the 0 theory.
Well, then the probability of the observed only if you look outside the galaxy, you include the galaxy. So if you include the galaxy, this number comes out about 5%. If you don't include the galaxy, it comes about 0.02%.
Yeah, so I think the real thing is the not including the galaxy.
Right. And the point
unless
is
we could probably go back and redo the
galaxy. Right. And if you include the galaxy, right. And yeah, so it's just why should the galaxy, I mean, the part of the sky that we really don't trust, after all, if you look at how one produces the ILC, right? There are, 12 regions that contribute to making this ILC map where you use different independent linear combinations. 11 of them are inside the galaxy. So that's the extent to which we don't trust how well we've seen, you know, the galaxy. So take the part of the sky outside that, and you discover there's no two-point correlation functions. Take the part of the sky inside that, you discover all of a sudden there's all these big two-point correlation functions at large angle. Why would you trust them? It's the part of the sky you don't trust.
But the other part of your message was, I think you're... Would you agree? We should forget about the anisotropy if we're interested in cosmology. That was what was coming out as the most significant event, but you're giving evidence that
cosmology. Well, the problem is that if we don't trust the CMB behind the galaxy, we can't calculate the orientations of the quadrupole octopole. We don't have enough information. You're losing 30% of the sky, and you no longer have enough information to calculate the quadrupole octopole. So it's true, you have two choices. You can trust the whole sky, and then you don't believe this display isotropy, and you go ahead and try to explain quadrupole optical alignment and why they align with the solar system. If you do trust it, if you don't trust, and I don't think you should, then you have to explain why there's no correlations above 6 degrees.
So let me ask It's been a very interesting talk. That's why everybody is here still. But so let me ask one question. So the part that I didn't find very convincing, that it's very striking that you have such a low correlation function. But saying that this rules out either Gaussianity or isotropy of the universe, that's a stronger statement. And to rule out Gaussianity, you would think that you should look at higher order correlation functions rather than just 2.5.
Well, I was careful. I was more careful. What I said is that it rules out the combination of Gaussian random statistically isotropic ALMs of zero mean. That's what it rules out. So you have to break. I don't know whether it's the Gaussianity or the statistical isotropy. For example, it could be that we have topology. What would you take the eigenfunctions of your manifold and they are in fact Gaussian random variables of zero mean. But then the ALMs that we see on the sky wouldn't be statistically isotropic. They'd be correlated with each other, for example.
So that's certainly a possibility, but I'm not sure that that's what all your analysis necessarily implies, because you're just looking at two-point correlation function, either in endless space or in real space.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on your estimator for C sub L, which, for example, use pseudo CLs, they are identical. Basically, real space correlation function is identical to...
But if you use it outside the galaxy, then you find...
Yes, let's say that you mask out the galaxy, you only look at data outside the galactic mask, and these two are identical, pseudo CL is identical to the correlation function.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just design a theory that gives you whatever correlation function that you see.
No, you can only design a theory that gives you a particular expected correlation function. You do that, you design it to give the correlation function you see, and then you find that cosmic variance spoils.
So that's your claim. Okay. So we should end. I think I'm not completely convinced about that. So any final quick pressing question? I guess not. So let's thank Glenn again for this very exciting talk.